This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
I think thyroid function is probably one of the critical elements in female reproductive health. It is involved in so much, as a lot of us know. So, you know, thyroid hormones are necessary for menstrual regularity, for ovulation, for implantation and pregnancy maintenance. If your thyroid's not functioning properly, that can disrupt ovulation, resulting in progesterone deficiency and also disrupting prolactin, FSH, LH, so all of those pituitary hormones.
Most of my patients are women and couples who are trying to conceive and early pregnancy support. And they really get very little thyroid management and testing in early pregnancy. You know, sometimes it's done at week 7, but really TSH and maybe sometimes T4. And then often not at all after that. So I'm actually, in many of my patients, saying, look, we want to actually watch this quite closely, particularly if there's been recurrent pregnancy loss.
I treat the preg still. I look at the obesity. Obesity is estrogenic. We know that. It's an estrogen's an obesogen, or obesity is an estrogen mimicker. We look at overtraining. We look at that calorie restriction and keto diets. We look at inflammation because, you know, we've talked about that. It decreases the conversion even. I look at chronic illness because of that simmering cortisol.
This is BioConcepts Between Clinical Minds, the podcast that's open-minded enough to take in all sides of a clinical story. You'll hear from researchers, doctors, naturopaths, nutritionists, and patients. We look at common clinical presentations through a different lens. It's open, frank, and sometimes controversial. Nothing is off limits. Will it change the way you treat? We'll leave that up to you. In season 3 of BioConcepts Between Clinical Minds, we look at thyroid health. We talk to experts in the field who will take you into their clinics and share their experience. I'm Tony Chambers, and this is BioConcepts Between Clinical Minds. In this episode of Between Clinical Minds, we discuss the impact of thyroid dysfunction on fertility with naturopaths Belinda Kirkpatrick and Natalie Pickering and functional medicine practitioner Alexandra Brewster. Natalie Pickering is a naturopath based in Perth. She specialises in women's reproductive health and fertility. She says thyroid health is essential from conception to infant development.
There's so many different levels. Starting from the very top, you need healthy thyroid even for the production of good levels of FSH. And the FSH is what's going to be really stimulating that follicular genesis. And we know that you've got to have good levels of thyroid hormone within the follicular fluid of the ovaries. And if you don't have that, it doesn't matter how much estrogen might be rising, but you're not going to have that growth response in the follicles. So, yep, we need healthy thyroid for follicular genesis to occur. We need it for healthy levels of FSH and LH to occur. We also need it for ovulation. You know, so many of us have patients whose periods have gone AWOL or they've started to have a lot of spotting or long light flows or really heavy periods, and it does often come back to the thyroid. We also need it. The healthy thyroid function is really important for implantation. It actually regulates endometrial receptivity. So if we have not had good thyroid function in that phase of the cycle, the likelihood in the earlier phase of the cycle, you know, during the follicular phase, then as we enter into the luteal phase, the lining simply isn't ready to be receptive. And I think that, you know, I think we'll dig in a bit deeper later on with IVF and estrogen levels and so on, but I think that does kind of explain why implantation is such a challenge for some of the women who are going through IVF. So coming back to your original question, Yep, it regulates implantation. It actually also regulates that trophoblast differentiation to stimulate in early placental development. And I think that we just have not been well enough aware of this, or it's not in the forefront of our minds. So, of course, also, you know, fetal neurodevelopment. And we now know there's some longitudinal studies that show that even if a child has good iodine levels during its early years and into pre-primary and so on, even if it has good iodine levels during that time, it can sometimes not recover its IQ, its measured IQ, if mama didn't have good iodine levels in pregnancy. Mm. So it's very much irreversible. It's setting out the neuron development, the myelin development in those early days and months in development in utero. Mm. We also know that thyroid health has got to be adequate to maintain fetal growth. Mm. And there is some research to suggest that sometimes those later pregnancy losses can be explained by inadequacy of thyroid hormone production. So I think there's such a lot of scope for us to dive in there and support our couples and our women who are struggling to maintain pregnancies where we couldn't really find any other reason for recurrent pregnancy loss. I think the robust thyroid health before the pregnancy and then maintaining it during the pregnancy is so very important. Mm. Yeah. And I think that it isn't explored very well. You know, hardly any of the, because most of my patients are women trying to, and couples who are trying to conceive and early pregnancy support. And they really get very little thyroid management and testing in early pregnancy. You know, sometimes it's done at week 7, but really TSH and maybe sometimes T4. Mm. And then often not at all after that. So I'm actually, in many of my patients, saying, look, we want to actually watch this quite closely, particularly if there's been recurrent pregnancy loss, we can't find any other reason. We check it at 6, check it at 8, check it at 10, because TSH is actually supposed to go down in early pregnancy, because HCG actually has a role similar to TSH to maintain pregnancy. So TSH should definitely go down in the first trimester. Mm. And if it doesn't, it's telling us, okay, the thyroid is not responding well enough.
But in what proportion of your cases do you think that the thyroid is playing a role?
I think that it's rising all the time. And I'd have to, look, I'm just going to put a pin in this and say somewhere around 25 to 30% probably have thyroid issues to some level. And I think, you know, when we were studying and learning about the thyroid and the causes of thyroid issues, it really was, okay, it's most likely autoimmune and then it could be iodine deficiency. But what I think we could and should be exploring more is that interrelationship between the thyroid and the adrenals, the thyroid and estrogen. You know, so many of us are estrogen excess and that will impact or lower our thyroid hormone production. And also progesterone deficiency. There's a real bidirectional relationship between the thyroid and the progesterone. You know, we need healthy thyroid to make progesterone, but progesterone's been found to stimulate the thyroid. So there's this cycle that we've got to kind of come in on. And I think there are a lot of women with undiagnosed thyroid issues, and the cause could be ovarian hormone, or it could be not just simple nutrient deficiencies and certainly not just iodine deficiencies, but all the toxins that we've been exposed to from early life, you know, whether that be flame retardants have been proven to disturb thyroid health, and non-stick, and, you know, not just on our pots and pans, but also on some of the clothing that we wear, and, of course, pesticides. So I think that I actually do not see thyroid issues reducing. I see it increasing. And to be honest with you, over the last 2 or 3 years, I think the impact of stress and trauma in the community as a general is really pushing up that cortisol impact on the thyroid, because, you know, cortisol is going to reduce TSH, it's going to reduce the conversion or the production of T3, but it also pushes the production of reverse T3. And it's so under-recognized, isn't it? So I don't see it reducing. And I think that if we come into any of our fertility cases with a keen eye on looking for the thyroid and its function. And yes, oftentimes we're asking our patients to spend more, but honestly, in this case, I think spending $150, $180 is going to save thousands in the long run, just so that we can really see, okay, what's going on with the thyroid? And, monitoring the basal metabolic rate from there. I actually had a patient in yesterday and her wedding is coming up tomorrow. We've been monitoring her cycle. She's has in the past suffered with hypothalamic amenorrhea with some twists and turns that I wasn't quite sure about why was she sometimes having these really long cycles. Anyway, her cycle's been going beautifully, which is great because she was planning to start trying straight away. But in the upcoming planning for her wedding, she sent me through her chart and it's all of a sudden dipped from 36.2s and 0.3s to down to 36.1s and 36.0s and 35.9s. And I'm thinking, okay, well, cycle suddenly stretched out. It's at day 69. This has got to be thyroid. We can see where the stress is rising. Temp dropped a little bit. Stress was getting even higher. Temp dropped further. So I think that's that cortisol on the thyroid. And I just feel like that's a very likely reaction with a lot of spotting that had been happening. Never seen that before. So it's exciting to think that we've got that next level of understanding and support to offer.
Belinda Kirkpatrick is a Sydney naturopath specialising in fertility. She says there's an increased risk of pregnancy loss when TSH is over 2.5 and when there are antibodies.
I do work a lot with IVF and assisted kind of reproduction. What they're seeing is that, you know, hypothyroid and particularly those with thyroid antibodies are far more represented in that kind of fertility space, you know, than anybody else.
Those antibodies are obviously associated with a significant risk of miscarriage. Mm-hmm. But how do you explain that mechanism and that link?
It is a really hard one, particularly when they do have thyroid antibodies and yet a normal sort of thyroid function, you know, particularly when they're having maybe implantation failure in the IVF setting, you know, or sort of not falling pregnant. It's like, oh, is this, how much of a part of their picture is this? You know, like we really don't have a really great grasp on that. Certainly some of the fertility specialists that I work with are like, yep, no, that's a thing. We need to be looking at it. You know, there is this sort of autoimmune inflammation picture and they're kind of communicating that with their patients. And others are like, no, your thyroid's fine, therefore you're fine, forget about it, kind of go away. You know, it is the most common autoimmune condition for women of childbearing age, I believe. And I think it's that inflammation and autoimmunity sort of affecting potentially on one of the pathways, implantation and endometrial receptivity, you know. So the body's such on kind of like high alert for whatever else is, you know, in that sort of self-attack moment. And, you know, I guess that autoimmune thyroid also damages the thyroid gland, you know, results in affected production of your thyroid hormones, which are really important for not only fetal development, but also can lead to dysfunction in the placenta, you know, which can then affect the nutrition and oxygenation of the fetus and again, increasing that risk of miscarriage. There's been a couple of research studies. In 2011, there was a meta-analysis looking at, I think it was four studies, showing that, yeah, the presence of thyroid antibodies in euthyroid patients was associated with unexplained infertility. And then another study looked at, you know, positive thyroid antibodies being associated with reduced ovarian reserve and lower antral follicle count. You know, so there's probably even more pathways and things that are being affected by that. And obviously, you know, association doesn't kind of mean causation, but certainly sort of clinically, I would be working more on that inflammation, autoimmune, sort of element in terms of, I mean, whether it's egg quality. So that can kind of be affected by autoimmunity as well. But then, look, certainly implantation seems to be, you know, a big part of it too.
An added consideration is prolactin levels. High prolactin can impact thyroid function and fertility. Alexandra Brewster, functional medicine practitioner and registered nurse.
When we don't have enough thyroid hormone, we suppress going at a trophy releasing hormones. Who makes these names up? I think they do it just to make themselves sound smart. Remember, GNFRH signals the pituitary to produce FSH and LH. So there's the connection. Mm. If GNFRH is suppressed, I'm glad I'm drinking coffee and not gin, just saying.
Me too. Now,
the pituitary gland holds the production of FSH and LH. This will affect both estrogen and progesterone production due to anovulation or irregular ovulation and corpus luteal dysfunction.
But how does prolactin work in here in this situation?
Prolactin decreases that GnRH we were talking about, so elevated prolactin. Don't even forget, we're just going to stop biochemical thoughts in the moment and just think people thoughts.
Yes.
When we are breastfeeding, mm-hmm. we don't want to be falling pregnant.
No.
And in fact, this is the reason I'm sitting here talking to you today, because God bless my lovely mum, I was told by her doctor in 1962 that you could not fall pregnant breastfeeding. Didn't work for her. So I'm 11.
Here you are.
11 months later, my mother cried when she found out she was pregnant. I'm 11 months younger than my sister. So before that, this is the body's way of saying, let's just deal with this baby. Mm. You know, let's halt. So halt ovulation. But low levels of serum T3 and T4 cause loss of that thyroxine feedback inhibition and the subsequent overproduction of that thyrotropin releasing hormone. Let's just call it TRH. Mm. And that's followed by the hyperplasia and hypertrophy of those thyrotrophic cells. But just the, in the pituitary we're talking here, Tony. Mm. So that also actually causes enlargement of those prolactin secreting cells. Just because there's not a lot of room in the pituitary and there's, you know, there's a little bit of a confusion going on, I guess. Mm. And also, did you know that the low thyroid hormone levels also decreases the clearance of prolactin from the body?
Mm.
So there we are, you know, me and my hamster wheels.
Yes.
There's another one. But the other thing we probably need to talk about is dopamine. So dopamine has a suppressive effect on the lactotrophs in the pituitary, right, the prolactin secreting cells. So it's all gone to hell in a handbasket with stress and we've got poor dopamine, and who hasn't? Like, think of those addicted patients. There's always low dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And dopamine needs a lot of tyrosine, and we've already talked about the thyroid hormone needs a lot of tyrosine.
Yes.
It all goes back to surviving that tiger.
Belinda Kirkpatrick says testing accuracy is an issue with prolactin.
So the amount of patients that I have that come back with really high prolactin, I'm like, were you sitting at pathology for at least 15 or 20 minutes prior to having that blood drawn? And look, most of us are waiting there for like hours, right? But like with the advent of certainly the patients near me will just book their slots now in pathology, which is just amazing. Mm-hmm. So they're just literally walking in and walking out. And so the pathology places aren't necessarily remembering to make them sit. And so if they've run straight in, it's like doing your blood pressure when you run straight into the doctor, it looks high. So I will often, I will always, in an elevated prolactin situation when it's out of the range, get them to go and do it again first up and make sure that they're sitting there for 15 or 20 minutes first. Mm-hmm. And probably about 60% of them come back and it's normal. Okay. So that's the first thing to kind of remember there.
Yeah.
But high prolactin does impact fertility though as well, interfering with that normal hormonal balance over in follicular development, ovulation, implantation, and then pregnancy maintenance. So we know that, you know, when you're breastfeeding, for example, and your prolactin levels are really high, that is suppressing ovulation, mm-hmm. and it can also then be affecting implantation as well. So, you know, it's doing that by inhibiting the release of FSH and LH, and then you're getting that decrease in ovarian steroidogenesis, which is necessary for ovulation and then, you know, maintenance of your corpus luteum as well. So, you know, if it's really high, your prolactin, you'll often get anovulatory cycles, mm-hmm. or I normally probably see like menstrual irregularities and then potentially sort of sub-fertility. It can also interfere though with implantation and maintenance of the pregnancy by inhibiting kind of progesterone production. And even in the IVF setting, when they're giving progesterone, you will often see that when the prolactin is elevated, those transfers just don't work as well, even with chromosomally tested embryos. And prolactin is not something that is always checked on, and or flagged when it's high as a reason for kind of subfertility. But certainly if we are able to kind of bring it down, we're certainly seeing better implantation rates in that setting you know, which is obviously, you know, what we're going for.
Would you go in and they've got high prolactin and they're doing assisted reproductive, then would you be giving things like stress support, B6, like you mentioned before?
If you can get it down between cycles, you know, I mean, it depends on why, right? You know, I mean, obviously if they've got some sort of pituitary microadenoma or something, yeah. But that's normally, well, 99% of the time that's been looked at. You know, if it's that high, they've had an MRI just to check, all that sort of been looked at. You know, it's not high enough to kind of need medication. Then often between cycles, I tend to find that Vitex B6 and zinc and stress support do work really nicely. Mm-hmm. If it's within the context of a cycle, I'll be using B6 and zinc. And, you know, that is a time of high stress. But, you know, really trying to kind of focus on that as much as possible, but yet without being stressed about being stressed. So, you know, it's what we can be doing to manage the effects of stress on the body. Mm-hmm. So whether that's, you know, I don't talk about try not to be stressed. I think, I don't know, gosh, that's probably the most stressful thing anybody could hear.
Yeah.
but, you know, can you add 10 minutes of meditation at the end of the day? Can you go for a 20-minute walk without your phone? Can you, you know, get up from your desk at lunchtime and eat your lunch outside in the sun? You know, just little things that are achievable for people that actually do help them to kind of switch off a little bit. But we tend to work better with what to do than what not to do.
So now onto IVF, can you talk to me about that impact that they both have on each other? So the IVF on the thyroid and vice versa.
Yeah. So one of the big things that I'll always suggest to women if they're planning to do IVF is we want to have that time to impact on follicular genesis and follicle development in those months before for so many reasons, but also because we do want to make sure that the thyroid health is quite robust before IVF begins. The process of IVF is the medications given to stimulate follicle development. They are going to really push estrogen up high. You know, in a natural cycle, estrogen might peak at sometimes only 700-800, up to kind of 1200-1300. Sometimes that's getting on the excess line. But in IVF meds, or IVF cycles, sorry, estrogen can climb up to 8,000, 10,000, 12,000. Mm-hmm. And we know that that causes increased production of TBG, thyroid binding globulin. So even though our levels of thyroid might look healthy, we're not experiencing that at a cellular level. Mm-hmm. So I'm always questioning, should we be doing a transfer of a follicle of a healthy little embryo at this point where we mm-hmm. know that there'll be some change in endometrial receptivity. You know, the markers that ensure that the endometrium receptive is ready for that little embryo, they're going to have been affected by the very high level of estrogen, increasing the thyroid binding globulin and impacting on the thyroid receptors that are in the lining waiting to receive, you know, the T3. So I think that having robust thyroid health is a really important part of being ready for IVF. And even if we're just thinking about those women who have FSH levels that are suboptimal, if we ensure that the thyroid is healthy, we can sometimes correct the FSH from that line. And we know that the months prior to IVF, if we're enjoying healthier cycles in the months prior, we also know that we've got a better group of follicles at the right level of maturation ready to respond to the medication. So it can really make a big impact on follicular genesis. Doesn't matter how much estrogen we throw at those ovaries, if there's not enough of the nutrient or even the thyroid hormone in the follicular fluid, we can't get great healthy mature follicles if we don't have all those cofactors, and thyroid's one of them. Yeah, so it can make a really big impact.
And what about some of the newer things or out-of-the-box things that you might be watching but maybe not necessarily employing so much?
I think that one of the things that comes to my mind is when we're testing the thyroid, should we also be sensitive to where we are in the cycle? Because I think the menstrual cycle could be really affecting TSH production. You know, did we happen to catch a woman when she's at, you know, just about to start a period and her progesterone's really dropped right off. So what could we expect with her? TSH and T4 and T3 levels. What about if we caught her and she's estrogen excessive and we've just caught her before her peak when she's about to ovulate and her estrogen might be at 1800 or something like that? I kind of feel like we might need to be a bit more sensitive to when we're timing our testing. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time I'll ask my ladies to do their testing at baseline, day two, day three, which is, of course, when your estrogen's at its lowest.
We have spoken about some treatments. We've definitely spoken about iodine. Are there any other? You've got some written down here, obviously selenium and inositol for autoimmunity. Others there that you would like to mention?
I often do lean into the herbal therapies as well, particularly in autoimmune thyroiditis. So, you know, in Hashi's, we'll often bring in withania. To be honest, I think withania plays a pivotal role in so many of my ladies, whether it be progesterone production, adrenal dysfunction and rebalance, or that thyroid piece. But then I'll come in with often echinacea and hemidesmus sometimes if indicated, Romania, definitely another beautiful adrenal tonic. And what else do I often use? Sometimes Nigella is indicated, and I think Nigella, we're on the cusp of learning a bit more about Nigella and autoimmune thyroiditis. I think that's quite a taste pretty dreadful though. It's definitely not just inositol and selenium because in my experience it's usually not enough. So correcting zinc deficiencies, looking at vitamin A because you know, the TGA labelling tends to make people quite scared of vitamin A.
So Nigella is interesting. Mm. Is that kind of a newish kind of...
Yeah, there is some studies available that show that Nigella can be really effective in reaching and in lowering thyroid antibodies and improving T4, T3 production. Mm. I think there's... might only be a few, but I feel like we're going to be on the cusp of finding a lot more about. Nigella is a great herb for male fertility as well.
We're not reductionists, Tony.
No, exactly.
I treat the preg still. I look at the obesity. Obesity is estrogenic. We know that. It's an obesogen's an obesogen, or obesity is an estrogen mimicker. We look at overtraining. We look at that calorie restriction and keto diets. Mm-hmm. We look at inflammation because, you know, we've talked about that. It decreases the conversion even. I look at chronic illness because of that simmering cortisol. I look at HRT and we're not going to be on the content, but how long have they been on the OCP for? Mm. Have they had the Mirena? Have they had... the implanon, you know, poor nutrition, processed diets, gluten, dairy, even organic dairy. Here's something we haven't talked about in thing of prolactin, because this is one I use for my fertility patients. Mm. And I, as I said, I talk to a lot of farmers. I quiz them. Mm. You know, I think it's the green ear tags you see on cows, on dairy cows. Maybe they've changed the colour. Mm. They are feeding the cow prolactin so they lactate longer. What's going through the milk?
Yeah.
So even my lovely Mongali milk that I'm drinking here, of course it's got prolactin in it. It comes from a lactating mother.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
EMFs, Wi-Fi, nutrition deficiencies, heavy metals, fluoride, bromine.
Is there anything out of the box that you're watching or that you use in these patients that help that's a bit out of the box?
I am keen on these new research on the T2 thyroid hormone, which is like there's some research to show that has an impact on fertility. So is there anything out of the box that I use? I honestly don't think so, Tony.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, only the hippie stuff. Literally get out there and lie in the forest somewhere, bathe in the ocean, go on a holiday to cut the cortisol down and just all your normal thyroid supporting stuff. And, you know, it's very interesting. It's not anymore, but I used to have an 85% success rate.
Oh.
And I think now it's just all the comorbidities and I'm putting it down to bromine. It's the big fat kid at the party sitting on the chairs meant for the birthday boy iodine.
All three practitioners are moderate iodine prescribers. Belinda Kirkpatrick.
So I have iodine anxiety. Just like to, you know, my name's Belinda and I have iodine anxiety. So I probably shouldn't even be saying this on a podcast. So many years ago, I've been in practice nearly 20 years, so probably 18 years ago, I had a patient and she was She had very low grade thyroid antibodies. Yep. She also had extremely low iodine and was symptomatic, you know. And I had her on a little bit of iodine, and I'd explained to her it's just for, I wanted to do it for like 6 weeks until retesting, and that was it, right? Anyway, she didn't come back. And a year and a half later, I had a call from her endocrinologist saying, oh my God, she's in a thyroid storm. You. I was like, oh, 2 years out, Pracky, you know, and you've created this thyroid storm, and you. She wasn't even buying it from me, right? Like I didn't even see her. Anyway, and I'd been very clear. And so I was clear on her dose sheet. And that was written at the time because of, you know, it was 100 years ago. Now it all typed, which is amazing. Cause I'm like, I am always like, it's only for this amount of time, needs to be retested, stop after you. So I think whenever you've had something happen, you're very, very careful. However, I don't think that's just why I'm not a big fan of the high doses. You know, I think, you know, from my point of view, and everybody's different, when you do iodine, I mean, you do need to check thyroid antibodies. Mm-hmm. That high dose or any iodine can flare thyroid antibodies. And, you know, if iodine's really low and they've got thyroid antibodies, you know, I'm super, super, super careful. Absolutely come in with, you know, make sure that zinc and selenium are corrected first, reduce as much inflammation. You know, extra iodine does make your thyroid work harder, which then increases production of free radicals in the thyroid, which can damage your thyroid gland. So, you know, I'd probably be looking at vitamin C and vitamin E and selenium to kind of really protect those sort of markers there. But look, in a day-to-day situation, I'm really probably only using between 250 and 500 micrograms a day, maybe up to a gram, but I barely can remember doing that. And I know the high-dose practitioners use that 5 to 50. Mm-hmm. I'm just not comfortable with it. But that's also too, it's just people are, and that's fine. It's just not within my scope of practice, and it doesn't mean I'm right. I'm probably not right. I'm probably just being really safe. And not to say those other people aren't being safe. You know, I think I probably use high doses of other things, and I do. Then people are like, what? You're using that much zinc, or you're using that much?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I've done that for years. I feel really comfortable, this particular patient. So it's not against anybody, but certainly when people do come in with that high dose, you know, they're already doing it from somebody else or online or wherever they've kind of got it from, I do very clearly write in their notes and on their dose sheet that that's not part of my treatment protocol, and that if they continue to take that doesn't have my support behind it. But that comes but that comes from my trauma.
In the next episode of Between Clinical Minds, we continue the conversation, this time on the common presentation of postpartum thyroiditis with Fertile Ground practitioners, naturopath Shantini Inkaran and counsellor Suzanne Hurley. Thank you for listening. We hope this podcast engaged and empowered you. And thank you to all of our experts. You can read more information on each of them on our website, bioconceptsengage.com.au. If you enjoyed this episode of Between Clinical Minds, please refer a friend and share the love. To continue the conversation, you can contact us at bioconceptsengage.com.au, where community is more than a concept.